So you are able to record from the... Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
It's the second hour of the exciting episode. Just in case you thought that you had already heard us another hour, you were correct.
Well, it could be deja vu all over again.
Yes.
So.
Because the future's just not what it used to be.
That's certainly true, and the future is always uncertain.
That seems like you have a lot of certainty in the future.
I have a not quite infinite, but very significant uncertainty about what's going to happen in the future. I'm reasonably convinced that Newton's laws will continue to be obeyed on the macro scale.
Yes.
Simply because I've seen no evidence otherwise. Anyway, we were talking about the corn hog cycle, but before we do that, we need to tell you that if you'd like to call in and make a comment or ask us a question or anything of that nature about something economic or something to do with the market or investing or something, please do so. 254-773-1400 is the telephone number to call. We're talking about the corn hog cycle and how it affects us. You see, so we have this cycle that's going on for centuries that can be traced back to at least the 1600s, when the price of grain that's fed to hogs and the price of pork fluctuates not together, but not synchronously, but out of sync, but at the same times. In other words, if it's a four-year cycle, then there is 4 years between the peaks of corn and the four-year and hogs. And people suddenly discovered, people started studying that and said, whoa, there's a distinct link here. And then people began to invest in predicting the future of that link, and people have been looking for links like that ever since.
I have to throw this in there. Anybody that's ever done any pig farming knows that there really is a distinct link.
Yes.
Distinct one, too.
Distinct
very
one
stinky.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Go ahead.
So this worked really well until high-speed transportation, relatively speaking, for cattle occurred because people, given a choice between beef and pork, generally tend to prefer beef. And
especially back at the beginning,
right,
when they've not had beef for most of their life except for extremely special occasions.
And so introducing beef in the form of cattle on the hoof that were delivered to butcher, to stockyards near cities, there's still one or near Fort Worth, disrupted the cycle. And it was further disrupted down the road when refrigeration blew the entire thing apart, because you could butcher the pig almost anywhere and almost any time and ship it in. And so you could ship it from all the way around the world, and you could ship the hog.
Same with the corn, and that you could freeze the corn and or can the corn. And
right. So the cycles that were so dependable got broken up by two things: new technology and new transportation capabilities.
There are some aspects that don't change with new technology. Human behavior is still pretty easy to recognize as not changing. How we get our food, how we get our oil, how we regulate our trade, all of that can change with new technology and does change with new technology.
Unfortunately, we tend to hang on to theories long after they have dissipated and are no longer functional.
Here's a really good example of a theory that is no longer functional. I'm going to use air quotes around this. Please don't take it out of context. Gold will always be stable in prices. I've got to remove the air quotes now, and that was true. It was fundamentally a truism of the entire world until all the countries left the gold standard, because it was artificially regulated by the governments to be a specific flat, stable price, and it was also artificially regulated by governments to say that you couldn't own it in any form that was money. except through money. And what that means is that as soon as the gold standard was removed, the perceived, the concept that gold would be stable forever went away as well, except people still believe it today. Anybody that's ever looked at the price of gold over a long period of time will see tremendous fluctuations up and down, and yet you still hear people talk about the stability of gold. It's a cycle that's no longer true, that we're still, some people are still basing their economic fortunes on.
So what we're seeing today is a disruption of economic cycles. And there are new players, and above all, there's new transportation and new technology. So some of the indicators, like the yield curve, may not be as reliable as they once were. They, matter of fact, they can become totally unreliable because there are new players involved, because of major changes in the way things work. For example, it used to be you could look at the Commerce Department, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and see that here is what's happening to profitability of companies in the United States, and you could then look at the stock market and see that reflected there. So what the BEA reported was a strong indication of whether the market was overpriced or underpriced. If the market was still going up but profits weren't rising in the United States, that was an indication that the market was about to go for a fall. Well, today, roughly 40%, that's the numbers that I've read at least, I'm not sure of the accuracy of that, but the, roughly 40% of the earnings of the S&P 500 are not coming from the United States, they're coming from outside the United States. And as a result, the dollar, as the dollar declines, which it's been doing and should do at this point, and the euro and other currencies rise against it, you see those earnings going up, A, because those countries are recovering, which is why their interest rates are going up and ours is not, and the dollar is going down. And also simply because that's just the way this particular economic cycle is working out. So you, the correlation between what's going on in the United States and what's happening in the stock market is rapidly dissipating. And yeah, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. First off, the fiduciary rule did not cover everything.
No, yeah.
The fiduciary rule, as it stated, only covered what's held in IRAs. Now, what's held in regular, theoretically what's held
IRAs in... IRAs and retirement accounts.
Regular retirement accounts, what's called ERISA-qualified retirement accounts, are theoretically already under the fiduciary rule, but in fact, it's not well enforced. But it, by including IRAs in there, which Congress basically directed the Labor Department to do...
In 2006, they directed them to do it.
So... Then that applies to that, but it didn't apply to everything else. And incidentally, one of the things that the Republicans in the House are pushing really, really hard to do right now is to have the budget bill that has to be passed by the 19th to keep the government open. Has it, the House version of it currently has a provision in it that will prevent any funding to enforce the Department of Labor fiduciary, enforce or research the Department of Labor fiduciary rule.
For those of you who have not listened to us for great periods of time in the past, a fiduciary, a simple definition of what fiduciary is someone who's required by law to work in the best interest of their client. Think of an attorney that's not doing malpractice. Think of a doctor. These are people that are supposed to work in the best interest of their customer. They come in, they sit down, they hopefully do not have ulterior motives to suggest a surgery. It's not always the case, but they've taken an oath, and there's regulatory practices that say if a doctor is recommending a surgery mm-hmm. that you don't need, he can lose his license, she can lose her license. An attorney that gives you items and bad legal advice consistently could lose their license. Mm-hmm. So this concept of fiduciary we all recognize the need for it. When it comes to investments, Congress recognized that as long as you were in a 401k at work, any advice that was given on that 401k by law had to be a fiduciary giving the advice. Somebody's got to be doing it in your best interest. As soon as it's no longer in the 401k, as soon as it went over into an IRA, it was buyer beware, caveat emptor. That is the sales world of be careful and do your own research. So Congress, and this was in 2006, said we should require that same standard to apply to the money. That it shouldn't matter if it's at the employer or at the employee's own, you know, account. It should be very clear. This is retirement money. It needs to have fiduciary advice. So the law was passed in 2006. It mandated that the Labor Department first do some studies to see what the impact was and then write some rules to say, here's how we would enforce fiduciary duty in the sales world when it comes to retirement accounts. And we had a final rule published that was supposed to go into effect last year, and it was delayed and postponed for another year because there's a tremendous amount of money in the lobbying groups that are saying this is going to, you know, the
it's
best
going to hurt the profits of the financial product industry.
Now, the argument against having a fiduciary standard is that people say, wait, somebody with a small amount of money is not going to be able to afford someone to give them advice as a fiduciary because there's liability issues, the cost of doing business that way is much higher. Obviously, anybody that's listened to us for very long knows that we think the opposite, that prices come down in fiduciary relationships so long as they are real relationships. If it was a relationship between a doctor and a patient rather than a doctor and an insurance company, prices tend to be pretty stable and low. When it's an insurance company, things go up. So as long as there's not a lot of middle people, having lower cost is associated with fiduciary advice over a longer period of time.
To give you some example of what we're talking about when you're talking about fiduciary, I get advertisements, used to get them daily. I'm getting them less frequently as I told my web browser to block them. From companies that would pay, if I were to sell a specific product that they're offering to one of my customers or clients to put in their IRA a particular product, they would pay me 7% commission. Now,
those are emails that we get regularly and we look at and we go, who could possibly say yes to that?
Yeah, but people do. Because
but people do.
So you're going to put $100,000, you're going to roll over $100,000 into your IRA. If a person who is your, quote, financial advisor, end quote, is offered on one hand the ability to see a $7,000 commission for advising you to get this investment, as opposed to this other investment over here, where that same $100,000 might get him a whole lot less. It might get him less. You might not get him only maybe a few hundred dollars is the most he would make for over a year's time for investing that money or advising you to invest that money. Well,
that, dear listeners, is called a conflict of interest.
And so the point is that the $7,000 one is going to win. And there were, at least when we were in the brokerage business, we routinely got advertisements from our broker-dealer, among other things, for companies that would pay 14% to the broker and the broker-dealer for the purpose of getting your money into the IRA with a very high-risk investment. And those don't meet the fiduciary standard. They don't meet much of any standard. In many cases, they've collapsed later on, and people are left trying to sue to try to get their money back when they signed off on a document. But it's a mess. So the issue of the fiduciary standard being taken up by states is that since the Republicans in the House of Representatives, specifically Representative Hensarning is the lead standard bearer for this, have done everything humanly possible to prevent the fiduciary standard for IRAs from being enforced once the rule was published, then
and the idea here is to keep this is the argument. Keep the market free, keep the market simple, and allow people to get advice that they choose.
And the point is that most people have
no idea
that it's conflicted.
Yeah, it all sounds great, except that if it's advice that they choose, most people don't have an education in how to choose investments. And if they go to someone and they say, this is a very common thing that we hear. How long have we heard this? Oh, I don't get paid when you invest. I don't get paid from you when you invest. The company pays me.
Right. But they pay me with your money.
That's beside the point. It's the middleman again. And you know, I made a statement that was a rather bold statement not very long ago, just a few minutes ago. I said that fiduciary advice tends to be less expensive if there are not middlemen. And I brought up doctors without insurance, mm-hmm. you know, and people that have only used insurance will look at me and say, you're insane. Prices are going up like crazy. Well, there's one area of the medical world that over the last two decades has come down in price by a factor of four. So it's 1/4 the price it used to be. The quality of care has doubled in that time period. Do you know what that sector is?
The non-insurance receiving...
Elective surgeries. Surgeries that do not require, that insurance companies will not pay for, whether that's LASIK eye surgery, whether that is a breast implant or a tummy tuck or all of those things, the quality of care has gone up and the price has dropped by a factor of four. Keep that in mind when we're talking about fiduciary. As long as you don't have massive enterprises getting in the way and making huge profits in between the fiduciary and the customer, prices tend to go down.
Mm-hmm.
And having that in mind, people are saying, well, the people with small amounts of money won't be able to afford fiduciary advice. There's already information out there to help with that. If you think about a 401k, nobody at your job tells you where to put that money. You're given choices. You do a little test online and they tell you where to put the money. Now, that may not be as great as having somebody's with great credentials and all of that telling you exactly where to put the money, but it's there. It means that you don't have to have someone get paid $7,000 for what in the financial world is not that large a transaction and maybe one that you do every year.
Actually, the British came up with a system that works very, very well, a fiduciary standard. In that there are three tiers to begin with, the financial advisors. But let's just say you go to the standard retail financial advisor. In Great Britain, the financial advisor can let you say you wanted to invest $1,000 and that's all you have. The financial advisor can say to you, there's several ways you can pay for this. You can write me a check for this much money. You can pay me this much money a quarter as a percentage of what you have in there, and it'll amount to this many dollars, or you can pay this much up front, which is the equivalent of what's called the load on mutual funds today.
And some people would accept that.
We'll take it out of your investment. In other words, it's exactly the same fee structure that exists today.
But the customer knows about it.
But it's stated at dollars, and the customer is given a choice, and they know how many dollars they're paying. And they, in essence, sign off on it, and everybody's happy. And this is the fascinating thing. It has not in any way apparently restricted the availability of an investment advice, but it has increased the quality of an investment advice. Now, among other things, the law that passed in Great Britain and the rules that were put into effect require that a person can't just simply say, ta-da, I'm a financial advisor. And I know the regulations. They actually have to understand the basics of it. They have to take the equivalent of some kind of certification that they actually know what they're talking about in the area of investments, A. And then B, they have to give you appropriate advice and you pay them a fee for it. And you've got different ways that you can pay the fee. And lo and behold, the people who pass the tests
get better advice.
Who stay in the business, A, they're giving better advice. B, their income hasn't dropped a whit. They're doing just fine because people, if they're made aware of what they're paying, are commonly perfectly willing to pay for it exactly the way they were before. They're just not hidden from
it. That's my answer to the common argument of we want to keep the market free. It's not free right now. It's obfuscated and ununderstood. It's kind of like when the banks were the only ones that were allowed to see your credit score. That was a free market. The banks put the data together themselves. They didn't need your input. They took your input from when you paid your bills. So why should they have to share with you the data on your credit score? Because it affects your financial well-being. That's why. If they've got bad data and it prevents you from getting a loan, you need to know where the bad data is so you can fix it. And the same is true with this. If you don't know what the costs are associated with the purchase, you probably shouldn't be making the purchase.
So let's go on to what the caller asked about. The states have become very frustrated with, some of the states are becoming very frustrated with the fact that the fiduciary rule has passed. The people in that state would like to rely on fiduciary advice. It's in the best interest of the client from people who claim to be financial advisors. And so several states are now looking at establishing rules within that state that says if you call yourself a financial advisor, it doesn't make any difference whether it's an IRA or anything else. You're going to have to give fiduciary advice, full disclosure, and full disclosure of all conflicts of interest, if there are any, to your clients or your customers. And that is causing a firestorm. Very frankly, if you do business with whether it's Edward Jones or A.G. Edwards or Merrill Lynch or any of the retail broker dealers, and you knew all the under the table transactions that went on as a result of your doing business with them, it would probably shock and horrify you. Frankly, I think in many cases, at least when we were in the brokerage business, we didn't know all the under-the-table transactions that were going on. And each broker-dealer has what they call preferred partners who show up at their big conferences and have big advertisements and do presentations and who, in effect, pay for these conferences at five-star resorts with for the representative and their partner of choice. If they sell enough of the stuff that their preferred partners want them to sell. So they have this obligation. In other words, they are receiving, in most cases, in a broker-dealer, and I don't know any exceptions to this, whether it's Merrill Lynch or Edward Jones or whoever, the representative you're working with gets paid extra in some form to sell certain products that have higher profit margins for the company. They make more money for the broker-dealer. They get paid less to sell others, and they're effectively forbidden to sell some of the most advantageous to you investments out there. They are forbidden to sell those. And their nature of the regulatory system they're under is if the broker-dealer says you can't sell it, they can't sell it. I don't know if this is still true, but some of the broker-dealers friends that I work with, used to work with, that I know today, have told me flat out, for example, we cannot offer Fidelity investments because they don't pay the broker-dealer anything. Or if we do offer the Fidelity investment, we have to charge a big extra fee for it. Well, why is that? Well, because their internal costs are so low that they can't afford to pay the broker-dealer, be it Merrill Lynch or Edward Jones or whatever, a bunch of money, which then pays for the conference or whatever, and you don't know about that. And the broker has got to make a living, so the broker is interested in doing what his or her boss, which is the broker-dealer, wants them to do, and they're trying to do the best they can. And in many cases, they are blissfully unaware and they're busy selling things. This is where the limited partnerships and the non-traded real estate investment trusts and the many, many, many exotic investments that have blown up over the years that have turned into nightmares for everybody that was associated with them, except the people who made a lot of money by selling them, have come from. And is there a purpose in going to the fiduciary rule? Yes. Do I think we should? Yes. I don't know that it's going to happen anytime soon because the lobby from the securities industry is huge. the amount of money that they pump into congressional campaigns is, particularly on the Republican side, is huge to prevent anything from happening that would cut into their profits when they're selling securities or investments to the public. And that's just an unfortunate reality, but it's one I think people should be aware of. If you don't mind buying something that may be a bit overpriced and thereby getting a lower long-term return, and you think that and not being told about it, then fine, charge on and have a good time. On the other hand, we tend to think that full disclosure and fiduciary behavior is in everybody's best interest.
And here's the thing, that in the meantime, between now and when this fiduciary rule actually goes into effect, if it does, I think it will, but it may not. There are ways that you can check if they remove funding for enforcement of this fiduciary rule. It's only going to affect the people that are already fiduciaries as far as overhead. We're still going to have to follow it. So this concept of what do we do if the fiduciary rule doesn't go into effect? Do your research. There are publicly available free sites, Morningstar.com. If you are offered a mutual fund from a broker, from an advisor, and they say, I want you to have this mutual fund, go to Morningstar.com, look up the mutual fund. It will have the fees. It will have the commission amount because the mutual fund has something called a ticker. And you can look that up very quickly on Morningstar.com and figure out exactly what this person is getting paid, or at least what their broker-dealer is getting paid.
You really can't. They don't tell what the commission is. They tell what the expenses are. They tell what the fund is charging, but not what the commission is charging, I don't think.
No, they do. Okay. They do. We just look at no-loads so much that you're not used to looking at it. I've just gone through a couple of portfolios for people and looked at what their commissions were, and my eyes bled a little bit and tried not to weep all over the analysis. And that's really what it comes back to. Fiduciaries are really looking at how do we get this low cost, how do we get the most efficiency out of it, and hopefully at some point we will have a fiduciary rule that says on all investment vehicles you've got to have fiduciary advice. Right now, even the concept that you might get fiduciary advice on an individual retirement account is a difficult thing to get. So getting it on everything, if you want fiduciary advice, we think you should have it. We're prejudiced on the issue because we function as fiduciaries. So we have a conflict of interest too, in that we think everybody should be a fiduciary in this business. But you know, what we think doesn't change the world very much. Sometimes it does.
The telephone number is calling here if you're interested in joining us. Our questions or thoughts or comments remain 254-773-1400.
Mm-hmm.
And you wanted to say something?
Yeah. There was an unemployment report that came out, or a jobs report that came out.
148,000.
148,000. And if you listen to the news, you hear the word disappointing, or you hear the word shrinking, or you hear the word job growth down, slows. I'm looking at the numbers going back to 2000, year by year, on job loss and job growth. In 2008 and 2009, about 8.6 million jobs were lost. This was the Great Depression, or the Great Recession. 8.6 million jobs gone in 2 years. Starting in 2010, we started getting some jobs back. 2010, we had 1 million jobs come back after losing 8.5 million. That's a really slow recovery. In 2011, we had 2 million jobs come back. Okay, we're starting to make some progress. Now we've gotten back 3 million. But the thing is, we've had people graduating from college and from high school during that time period too. So there's more people coming on the market. And for the next several years, all the way through, there's not been less than 2 million jobs created per year going forward. However, the number of new jobs were going up consistently every year from 2010 to 2014. So over a four-year period, there were more new jobs every year than the year before. Starting in 2015, we started having less new jobs come online than the year before. Still more than 2 million per year, but less. And if you do some very easy math, you'll see that in the year 2013, we replaced all the jobs that were lost in 2008 and 2009. So all the new jobs that have come since then have been making up for people getting out of college, people coming out of high school, people coming back into the workforce. We've now created about twice as many jobs as we lost during that time period. We're at, in any way you want to look at it, full employment, which means don't expect to see lots more jobs being created with new people being hired because there aren't enough people to hire anymore. What we're seeing in these, the news media saying disappointing job numbers, 148,000 is a pretty good number. It is above population growth for a month, which means we're still creating new jobs for new enterprises beyond the new people coming on the scene.
The other thing about the 148,000 number, the reason it isn't news from our perspective is it's a one-month number. And particularly, there's a couple of months out of the year, and one of them is December, when the seasonal adjustment for job growth is huge. And there, in this time period is really, really big, and it is often adjusted in the months to come. They'll go back and make big adjustments to these. And the reason is, seasonal hires have to be filtered out of the system when they say adjusted numbers.
Right. So in the summer, at the end of the summer when all the kids go back to school, mm-hmm. or at the beginning of the summer when all the kids are leaving school, all these jobs, all these people seeking jobs come on the market. And if we allowed that to go into the numbers, you'd see these big weird spikes and drops.
So we don't know. And because of the online issue, remember I told you that a lot of the indicators we've seen in the past are not as reliable as they used to be because technology is changing and geographically we're changing. A lot of the numbers are not as reliable. And so the fact that we're down to 148,000, although it's below, it's supposed to be 180 and the estimates are 180 and it's 148. Look at a longer term moving average and I feel a lot more comfortable with it. And the second thing is I don't know that the seasonal adjustments that the Commerce Department does are very accurate at this point, right? Because the retail market is changing so fast.
And we look at other, like ADP's report shows really good growth in jobs. And what that says to us in the middle of this is that we have a vibrant economy. It doesn't say we're not about to have a crash, because this is a lagging indicator, not a leading indicator. People don't hire because they're about to make money in most businesses. They hire because they're making enough money that they can afford to hire someone.
Well, this is exception being manufacturing.
Yeah, exception is manufacturing. New manufacturing jobs.
And the manufacturing jobs were near the top of the list. Construction jobs near the top of the list. And that means that they've got the long-term contracts to train people to do the work.
Right. So all of that is good news. We've got to play some commercials for this hour. So we'll be back on the other side with more of from the Personal Wealth Coach with
Jeff
and Jake McClure. We are open to conversation from you, the listener. If you'd like to call us, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we've got about 18, 17 and a half minutes, something like that, left in the second hour today on January 6th, 2018. First presentation of the new year of 2018. And our telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400 if you'd like to give us a call and ask any questions or make comments or whatever else you had going on there.
I had a subject if you didn't have one.
Well, I've got one, but
okay,
what do you got? I just one of the things if you want to be afraid of something, at least we can be all equally afraid. A report came out, news media came out with report that apparently Intel and other chip makers
patch your computers immediately and your iPhones.
The issue, of course, is that patch it and that'll keep some of the problem out. That'll keep the, what is it, the meltdown out, but it won't keep the other one out because it's just basically built into the chip that runs it. No one, there's been no effort. I mean, there's been no evidence so far that anybody has taken advantage of this chip flaw. How it's going to be fixed, I don't know. Although Barron's came out with a interesting startup company called Polyverse that basically has come up, a guy who used to be the chief information technologist at Morningstar, which that sounds like a really impressive job, has come out with a system that probably can beat that, and it will basically eliminate the threat of, in many ways, the threat of hacking on computers. I'm hoping that that works real well. The good, you know, and if that scares you, that that somebody could get into your computer and get all the information, well, yeah. Don't be too scared of that. And the reason I say that is there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, let me come at this.
Let me finish this one thing. What you can do is make sure you're getting the updates from whoever your computer is made by and you're having them installed. If you're running XP or earlier, you're not getting updates.
Yeah, and that's not just Microsoft. Apple has announced, they announced yesterday that every iPhone and every Mac, every iPad have these vulnerabilities. So most of you have patches updated without even realizing it. If you've got an iPhone and it's doing its patches, it does a, hey, the phone updated, then you're in good shape. If you're not doing those updates, if you're saying they annoy me or I don't want them, then you're leaving yourself vulnerable. And the thing I wanted to say a minute ago was that at the beginning of the transportation revolution of the automobile, there were no car keys. The doors were unlocked. There was no ignition. In fact, in many cases, it was just a crank in the front of the car. And people didn't steal cars because most people didn't know how to drive cars. As cars became more prevalent, it took a demand from the consumers to say, hey, we need some more security here. I need to be able to lock my doors. And that's still going on. So keeping that in mind, when you're talking about your computers, this isn't the first time this has happened to humanity. It happens with new technology on a regular basis. Security is important, and we should be demanding more security from the major people.
Okay. We got a caller?
Yep, we do.
So caller on, that's on 773-1400. You're on the air with a personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Hello.
It sounds to me like it could be a flying fox.
A famous flying fox.
The fabulously famous flying fox. Me too. He makes me feel stupid about 80% of the time.
That's unintentional.
And I, of course I did. Well, I'm honored. Thank you. I think that's good guidance for people, too. If you're dealing with a person who's a financial advisor, say, I want to, and by the way, it's best to have it put in writing. Say, I want to know everything I'm being charged and everything you get if I buy something.
When you know the idea of paying a fee for to somebody, I think it's largely misjudged by people like the car salesman. He's not, no way a car salesman is going to tell you what, how much money he's going to make when he sells you a car. Because if he's afraid, if he tells you, you won't buy it. I think it's obviously true. I think people would rather deal with somebody that speaks to them honestly and flat out tell them what the cost is going to be. I know that's true with me.
Well, that's well, you know, that, you know, what you're saying is backed up by what happened in the United Kingdom when they came out with a complete revamp of their regulatory system for, quote, financial advisors, end quote. And they included the investment advisors and the financial advisors instead of having two different organizations or three different organizations regulating them. They basically said, take all the financial products, put them under one regulator, and you can continue to charge whatever you want to charge. But you have to fully disclose it and give people a choice on how to pay for it. And people got a lot happier. And I completely agree with you. Although I will say that there are a lot of investments that are sold even today in the United States, where if people knew what they were actually paying in terms of fees, it would freak them completely out.
Yeah, I agree with that.
We see them all the time. That's not true.
I looked at that account that you have for me. If I read it right, it was a big number that says total amount I put in, and the total amount that I've been paid out, and it looks like that I have been, over the years, I have received 50% of what I put in, and I still haven't. So people might like to know that.
Well, that's always a good thing to know. Of course, your account's different from other people's accounts. Past performance is no guarantee of future returns. Close cover before striking. And
we did not ask you to say this.
And be sure that your parachute is thoroughly strapped on before getting out of the airplane if it's still flying.
Right. If the plane's not flying anymore, then the parachute's not as necessary.
Right. All right. Thanks.
Appreciate that.
And by the way, the guy who just called is anything but dumb. He's done more in his life and written more books and done more amazing things and accomplished more things than probably, and I am not in any way overstating this, any three or four successful people I've ever met in my life.
He's ridden on the top of rail cars and avoided being beaten by the rail bosses and has flown airplanes
right.
with princes in them.
And flown jets around the world and flown small aircraft across the Atlantic Ocean.
Without proper guidance.
Retired as a full colonel in the Army.
He's an amazing guy. An amazing guy. Yeah. So anybody that
he's written a bunch of books.
A lot of books, yes.
A bunch. That's a technical term.
Yes. Right. All right. So I have something that I wanted to bring up, if
sure.
you're finished with that subject. And that is that while we have talked about the fact that we believe Bitcoin to be a mania and that it's dangerous, there's another area that we have not discussed much associated with Bitcoin that defines some of that danger a bit more. There are, this is a securities, the SEC announced that they are finding about one Bitcoin scam a day, new Bitcoin scam, or cryptocurrency scam. Usually somebody comes to the market with a new initial coin offering or a new type of cryptocurrency and they release it to the market, only they don't even have the virtual currency on a computer anywhere. It's just in their head, which when you think about it, isn't that different than having it in a computer. But that's, we've gone into scam world now. There was the South Koreans have busted up a $38 million Bitcoin Ponzi scam that started with just a few weeks. people are losing bitcoins to hackers on a regular basis. There's a final judgment against a guy named Josh Garza last month, or I guess it was in October, for a $9 million fraud having to do with mining Bitcoin, mining cryptocurrencies when it was a fraud. So there's things like OneCoin and Recoin, and basically you throw the word coin in it and people are willing to forget about all of their own research requirements, forget about all of the things that they would normally do. If someone asked them to buy a car with $10,000, they would want to open the hood and kick the tires. When somebody says, well, hey, look at the potential for growth here, and it's a scam, they don't even check. So be careful with cryptocurrencies. They're dangerous on the surface, and the scams are 100% dangerous. Please do your research, do some background stuff, and even if you're convinced that the person that's telling you about it believes it to be right, check beyond the person that's telling you, because the best scams use salespeople that totally believe them to be not scams. The best scams will use people that you trust who have also been scammed. So do your research and you may be able to protect the person that you trust as well as yourself. This is true on just about any scam, but the Bitcoin scams, the cryptocurrency scams are coming out our ears at the moment.
That's a strange place.
Yes, it's a virtual ear. It's not a real ear. It's a crypto ear.
Well, one of the things that this is a factoid, I think I mentioned this last week, I'm not sure, but it's still worth noting. There's two sources of new money about to enter the United States economy. One of them is going to be a huge one-time surge of money, and that is money that's being returned from overseas.
Yeah.
Because the companies are going to pay taxes on it overseas. And by the way, some of the big banks like Goldman Sachs had to take some huge write-offs in the fourth quarter because the bill was signed in the fourth quarter on their overseas holdings, which would be taxed in the United States. But now they can bring them home for free. Now, that money looks like it's going into mergers and acquisitions and share buybacks mainly.
There are some companies that are willing to use this money to do new hires and expansion and so on, but it's harder to do.
But there's a second windfall that's going to occur in a lot more companies, and it will be a much larger increase in terms of dollars because that money overseas doesn't necessarily come home because some of it is pretty illiquid, so it's not coming home right away. And that second increase is the tax cut, which I'm going to make a guess here somewhere between 20 and 28% tax cut for corporations and companies across the United States. And if a company was paying $1 million in taxes, they're going to have $200,000 to $300,000 in money, fresh money this year they didn't have before.
Right.
And if they take that $200,000 this year or $300,000 this year, and they invest it in a new hire, then obviously they get to expense some of that, but some of it they don't get to expense. Some of it they've got to pay in taxes on the new hire. If they invest that money in a new piece of equipment, let's say a robot, so that they don't have to hire new people.
Or a dog.
But I don't know if you can expense off a dog.
But
you can't a robot. There's a couple of big advantages to a robot. They don't join unions. You don't have to pay payroll taxes on them. You don't have to pay health insurance on them. And you don't have to pay retirement investments for them. You do depreciate them, but workers depreciate too. But you can't depreciate a worker, which is one of the goofy things.
Well, I know a lot of depreciated workers.
They are, but you can't depreciate them on your taxes.
Right.
So the point is that
there's underappreciated as well.
One of the peculiarities of this tax law that was, I think, an unintended consequence is rather than giving an advantage to a company for hiring new workers, there's almost nothing in there that puts an advantage to a company. There's no bonuses. There's no, if you hire new workers, we'll give you this kind of a discount.
Right.
There are unintentionally, I believe, in the various provisions of this act, built into the system a lot of bonuses for replacing workers with robots.
Yeah.
In other words, there's a tremendous tax advantage. A company can't take the price of the training over the next several years of a new employee as they come on board and they gradually come up to speed and write it off as soon as they hire the employee.
No.
They can if they buy a new robot.
And in many cases, the training cost of an employee is very hard to quantify. If you have an employee and you're paying them, well, you pay them, and that's deductible on your taxes. You paid it to them. But you have another employee who was previously making something or doing something that was profitable to you. And that other employee, the old employee, has to stop what they were doing to train the new employee. There's a cost associated with that that you will never get a deduction for.
And we are virtually out of time.
Yes, we've got 1 minute left. If you would like to contact us off the air, we do give fiduciary investment advice through the Personal Wealth Coach.
And management
to people of high net worth. And we will talk to you even if you're not sure what that means. If you would like to call us and leave a voicemail during the weekend, if real life people call and answer during the week.
254-947-1111. That's 947-1111 locally.
Or you can reach that toll free at 1-800-914-7526. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.